Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Republicans in the Ohio General Assembly want to address what they believe is a liberal bias on the state's public colleges, on the campuses of the state's public colleges and universities. The GOP-controlled Senate last week voted 21 to 10 to ban faculty strikes and most mandatory diversity, equity, and inclusion training, and to punish professors who fail to create bias-free classrooms. The Ohio House is considering a companion measure and already has started hearings on that. Similar legislation is pending in Republican-controlled states across the country, thanks to the National Association of Scholars. That's a conservative group pushing to reshape higher education in the U.S. Anna Staver is a State House reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. She's been covering the story. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, this isn't just about Ohio, right? This is happening in something like two dozen states.
Yeah. So, most notably, the big three that you're really hearing about are actually Ohio, Florida, and Texas. So the Florida law was just recently signed last week by Governor Ron DeSantis. So that's actually one of the first sweeping pieces of legislation to go into effect. Texas is actually considering three bills that kind of do what our one bill does, to give you a size of the Ohio legislation. Okay. You know, Texas broke it into three separate pieces of legislation. But they all address this idea, or they start from this premise that, conservative voices on college campuses are being unfairly silenced, and that the state needs to push back against that censorship. That's sort of where the origin of all of these legislations.
And what is the evidence of that premise?
So you can probably trace it back to, there's a number of different anecdotal examples that they'll give. But for me, I think one of the big things was, if any of your readers have ever heard of the book, The Coddling of the American Mind, it was by Jonathan Haidt in 2018. And it came from an Atlantic article that he wrote in 2017 about this idea that college campuses were becoming this place where we were protecting kids from speech that upset them. And that was this premise. And there was a whole host of articles in publications like The New York Times and Vox and The New Republic. And then it culminates in this big book. And they, some of it is articles about, I don't know if your readers know, listeners, I'm
no
so used
problem.
To print.
Yeah. I didn't even bother me.
But, there were some pretty famous disinvitations of very controversial speakers. Milo Yiannopoulos is probably the most well-known. But, Condoleezza Rice was going to give a commencement speech, and there was a lot of pushback against her. And there was this question, I guess, in conservative circles about whether, pushback against certain speakers, pushback against certain ideological perspectives being talked about in class was appropriate.
I know what you're talking about. I know those examples. But what's the evidence that it's somehow pumping out a bunch of liberal biased graduates?
That is one of the questions. So it's not so much that I think when you talk to Senator Serino, the sponsor of the bill here in Ohio, he says it's not so much that it's changing people's viewpoints, but that it's silencing. So a conservative student will lie about what they believe in order to pass a class. And that they
That's
feel,
an anecdotal
Yeah, that they
example.
Feel like, well, so in, very interestingly, there were two studies, one at the University of Wisconsin and one at the University of Virginia in the last couple years. And they were student surveys, which is really interesting, right? So how do students feel about this particular idea? And conservative students at both universities were far more likely to say that they do self-censor, that they do not feel comfortable in class. But what was so interesting about these surveys was the majority of them said it was their peers that were keeping them quiet, not the professors, that they didn't want to be socially isolated, that they thought maybe a belief about gay marriage would make their friends not want to be friends with them. And that's a much harder thing to control for, right? Mm-hmm. A professor can provide a classroom completely free from bias. But if I think I won't get invited to the party Friday night because I have a certain belief about abortion or gay marriage, I'm not going to speak up.
So how does someone like Senator Serino respond to that? How does this legislation, in other words, address what they say is the real problem?
Yeah, I think what they want to say is that they want to make sure that no professor is making belief in a specific ideology contingent upon passing their class, which there is large debate over whether that actually ever happens. I wouldn't say it never happens. I'm sure there are some professors that are bad professors. Like in the we have 4,500 like higher institutions in the United States. Like some of somebody's hired somebody bad.
Again, anecdotal though.
Yeah, and that's one of the real questions is, you know, even when you talk to the opponents of this bill, like the minority leader, Nikki Antonio, who was a college professor, she's like, look, we all want to create classrooms where students feel safe in expressing their ideas, where we can debate the merits of things, where we can show them maybe, you know, documentation that might conflict with their ideas, help them sharpen what they believe and why. The big question is, I think Senator Serino and Senator Antonio both have that idea. It's just, how do we get there, right? How do we create that marketplace of ideas where people can debate things in respectful manners and have very divergent viewpoints? I mean, you know, seeing the way the state lawmakers go after each other, I don't think it's like a teenage problem.
Yeah. In other words, peer group pressure isn't just for the young.
Yeah. I mean, being able to have like polite, respectful discourse when you like disagree about a core value, that's challenging at any age.
We're talking about efforts in legislatures across the country to tighten up the rules on what can be taught in publicly funded colleges and universities. In Ohio, it's Senate Bill 83. It's moved to the House now, where they're considering companion legislation. That means another bill that's very, very similar, so they could get that underway. And eventually, I assume the bills will be merged, or they'll pick one or the other. My guest is Anna Staver. She's a political reporter for USA Today's Ohio Network Ohio Bureau. She covers state house politics for the Columbus Dispatch. If you have a question or comment coming up this hour, we're going to have two points of view talk about this later in the program. We're going to have someone from the PEN America, where they're have a big fight going on to fight government censorship in educational institutions. And we'll also hear from a professor emeritus from Ohio University who is on the board of the National Association of Scholars. That's that conservative nonprofit pushing for legislative changes to higher ed. I'd like to hear from you as well. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Do they talk ever, lawmakers who want these changes in state colleges and universities, about what the potential downside is? In other words, maybe a parent doesn't want their kid going to a college where they don't have diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, for instance.
Yeah. So, you know, the Senate Bill 83 got a pretty big rewrite. They had a substitute bill, which for folks, like, amendments are like changes to a bill. A sub bill is an entire rewrite of the legislation.
Supposedly a little more extensive.
Yeah. And so he put some clarifying pieces, like even the opponents will say, like, he put some clarification about like that the prohibition on a university as a whole taking a public opinion on a controversial topic does not apply at all to professors or students in classrooms. Right. So there was some I think he sort of recognized that the way that was written, it could be misconstrued. Like, you can't have a climate change debate in class. And so he did. There was some like clarifying language to protect like the like expansive ideas that could be debated in class. But there is this question, right, of would this hurt recruitment of kids to Ohio universities? Would it hurt recruitment to other kids coming from outside of Ohio? And, you know, one of the things that changed was there was a ban on co-degree programs with Chinese universities. This is an entirely different section of this bill. And he changed it from an outright ban to let's have extra scrutiny on Chinese partnerships. So not getting rid of, say, the University of Cincinnati's co-engineering program with a Chinese university.
Which is very successful. Yeah.
Yeah. But putting extra like scrutiny on that relationship. So he did modify it in that way, sort of saying, oh, OK, like getting rid of some of these co-degree programs could be problematic. He also modified it to allow mandatory DEI training if it's required for, say, a grant or a federal requirement, because there are certain like accreditation programs, national accreditation programs, that require that now.
But when they reduce it to just those situations, the economies of scale of a DEI program at an institution the size of Ohio State is affected.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Voluntary DEI training would absolutely be allowed. But one of the examples that came up in the committee hearing that I thought was very interesting was, like, let's take campus police, right? Let's and if there was, say, credible evidence that there was a racial bias in campus police at OSU. I'm not saying that's the case, totally hypothetical, right? But if you had that, if you had evidence, wouldn't that be a situation perhaps where you would want mandatory DEI training, saying we have a systemic problem in our department? We would like mandatory DEI training to correct it. The bill would still not allow for that.
Okay. And then what if you're an African-American high school senior thinking about going to a state school? What are your prospects? I mean, what are they going to be thinking about? What are the thoughts about that?
Oh, that's it's hard for me, you know, as a almost 40-year-old white woman to think about how I would feel as a 17-year-old person of color. But I think, you know, that was one of the questions that has come up. This will not apply to private colleges. So that would always be the option, arguably the more expensive option. But it also, you know, was the sub bill was rewritten to make clear that, like, historically black fraternities, sororities, you know, LGBTQ groups on campuses would not be banned from associating. There was even a question about whether this free from, like, discrimination on the basis of, like, sex, race, religion, gender in campus groups could have put an end to single sex dormitories. So there was some clarification that these organizations would still be allowed to exist and sort of coalesce around a specific ideology or sexuality or skin color. Like, so there was, like, some tempering of that. But yeah, it is a real question, especially if you think, you know, that a university can't address issues of systemic racism that might actually have real world examples on campus.
Mm-hmm. The Board of Trustees, everyone was surprised when the Ohio State University Board of Trustees came out and with some concerns about this. They never say anything about anything.
It was, as we put it, a rare public statement. And that's true. They did come out and say that they thought that this would harm the university. And they're the largest university in the state. They obviously, the Buckeyes are wildly popular as a football team. Mm. Like, you know, I think they have a very big voice down at the legislature, and how much of an impact that's going to have, I'm not entirely sure. But, like, you know, it wasn't until Ohio State got on board with the name, image, likeness law that we actually saw it change.
How are they going to have you asked Senator Serino about enforcement?
Yeah. So this is where the teachers' unions, right, the get really involved, and where you see a lot of professors push back. So there would be annual teacher evaluations, right? They create a structure for evaluating professors, and they would be evaluated on a number of different things. But one of them would be creating a classroom free from bias, and there would be a student survey that would get factored into that evaluation that would ask students whether the professor created this classroom free from bias. And that would count for a significant part of their teaching score. And consistently low scores would then have to be used in determining whether to keep a professor. And it also creates this post-tenure review process.
A lot of red tape.
Yeah. And so this post-tenure review process would also evaluate you on these, and consistently failing scores could result in the loss of tenure and the termination from a university. So there were very clear penalties and a system of evaluating professors at universities for failing to meet the standards of this law.
Still, I mean, there's a lot of questions about giving students that much power, particularly when it could be transactional when it comes to grades.
Yeah. So I talked to Senator Serino about this, and he said, yeah, I'm sure there are students out there
I know there are students out there. Grade grubbers are legion.
Right. But he thinks, like, in the aggregate, like, most students wouldn't behave in such a way. So if you have a handful of bad reviews, like, and a bunch of really great reviews, that, like, your score wouldn't be dinged enough that, like, it could be problematic for your career. That, you know, you could sort of see, okay, well, there were 10 students that gave her bad reviews, but, like, 100 that gave her good reviews, because there's always going to be bad actors. But I guess we would all like to believe in the better angels, that, like, you would give a fair evaluation of somebody, not just.
Did you have evaluations when you were in college?
of my professors.
We didn't have them.
Well, so...
I mean, we had these kind of formality type things at the end of the class, but...
Yeah, but I would say, well, that's just like when the... We rate my professor and those types of things were getting off the ground. So, like, more like social media stuff.
Yeah, we were still, you know, doing chiseling on stone when I was in college, so... we didn't have things like the internet.
Informally, though, like, I mean, we absolutely talked about professors, right? Like,
sure.
You don't want this person. They're a terrible human, blah,
or,
blah, blah.
He's a tough grader, but he's a great teacher.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Those kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like, students talk amongst themselves about who you want and who you don't want.
Easy A, hard A, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Hmm.
My guest is Anna Staver. She's political reporter for USA Today Network, Ohio Bureau, and the Columbus Dispatch. We're going to keep her with us this hour. We're going to bring to the conversation opponent and proponent of this legislation that we're talking about, legislation that is pending or passed in some 26 or 27 states in the country. Florida is the latest to pass the legislation. Ron DeSantis, the governor there, signed it into law, I think, in mid-May. It does a lot of things. As Anna said, the Senate Bill 83 is a big, fat bill that does a lot of stuff, affects a lot of people, and however, is limited to state-funded colleges and universities. Private colleges and universities are not involved. And I'm kind of curious about, you know, if they're kind of thinking, okay, yay. I mean, they do actually give out a lot of scholarships and things like that at those private institutions. And they compete with Ohio State for the best students.
Yeah. Well, initially the bill was going to apply to them because they do occasionally private universities will come to the state for grants in something called the capital budget. And
right.
The capital budget is like, I have a project that I would like you to partially pay for. And so sometimes private universities come and they were going to say, hey, if you're coming for those grants, you have got to follow these rules. But they scrapped that. So that's no longer in the legislation. And I think that's particularly because, like, one of the arguments with private school at any grade level is that you're not bound by some of the rules that, like, the state sets forth. Actually, non-chartered, non-public elementary schools don't have to follow state standards. So I think the private schools themselves were saying, we want to have a litmus test for professors if we are a religious university, right? Like,
right.
That would be one of those things. And
so it could, that would be, it's not the liberal universities in that sense, that, and then it's the more conservative or.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, right, there are universities that are centered around a faith. There are, and theological universities, and they obviously want to only hire people that adhere to their particular faith for very obvious reasons. And, you know, one of the things we've said is, like, yeah, you can do that as a private institution.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Bring your questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to the Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Republican presidential candidate and the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, in mid-May signed into law a ban on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at state universities.
If you want to do things like gender ideology, go to Berkeley. Go to some of these other places. That's fine. It's fine. And there's nothing, if that's what you want to do, there's nothing wrong with that, per se. But for us, with our tax dollars, we want to focus on the classical mission of what a university is supposed to be.
We're talking about the Florida law and other similar measures in dozens of conservative states, including Ohio, that would do away with mandatory diversity training. And in Ohio, particularly, ban faculty strikes and punish professors who fail to create classrooms free of bias, largely judged by the students in those classrooms. Still with us is Anna Staver, State House reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Richard Vetter is a board member of the National Association of Scholars. It's a New York City-based organization that's one of them pushing for these legislative changes to higher ed in Ohio and other states. He's a professor emeritus at Ohio University. His 2019 book is titled Restoring the Promise, Higher Education in America. Richard Vetter, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you, Ann, and I wish you luck in your future as you step down after tomorrow's show, I guess.
Thanks, Professor. Jeremy C. Young is the Freedom to Learn Program Director at PEN America, where he leads the organization's efforts to fight government censorship in educational institutions, with a particular focus on higher ed. A former history professor, his 2017 book is titled The Age of Charisma, Leaders, Followers, and Emotions in American Society, 1870 to 1940. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me on.
First of all, I wanted to start, Richard Vetter, and just make sure we understand thoroughly the nature of the organization that you're representing today, the National Association of Scholars. I described it as a conservative organization. How do you describe it?
Well, it's a group of academics. Many of them, I would say, I'd use the word traditionalist more than conservative. I think a lot of them are conservative. They believe in teaching things like Jeremy likes a lot, history. They believe that there should be a core curriculum in universities. They believe that there should be freedom of expression in universities. I don't know that these concepts are themselves particularly conservative or liberal by their nature, but I suspect the majority of the public would say that the National Association of Scholars, I mean the scholarly public, would say that it is a relatively conservative organization.
And then another question, Richard Vetter, was there some kind of heyday in higher ed that you look back on, some bygone era that represents for the rest of us what you're talking about?
And that's a great question, because one of the virtues, there are very few virtues of getting old, but one of them is I grew up in higher ed in the late 50s and the 1960s, and I consider that the golden age. Enrollments were going up every year, 5%. Budgets were going up every year. Higher ed was venerated and so forth. Here in Ohio, we were creating new universities right and left, Cleveland State University, Wright State University. Jobs were hard. It was hard for universities to find professors. Teaching loads were going down. Salaries were going up. So from the standpoint of a professor, it was a golden age.
But was it this kind of access to history, core curriculum, and freedom of expression that you're seeking in proposing or and speaking for these kinds of bills?
You know, that wasn't much of an issue in those days, because most universities had, for example, strong general education requirements. Most of them had required courses in history, for example, just to pick that discipline. Many of them had, depending on the nature of the university, some of them had foreign language requirements, mathematics requirements, and so forth. And there's some of that still left, but it was much more considered part of the university experience in those days, I think, than it is today.
Okay.
Can I ask a question about that? Is that all right?
Yeah.
I just want to ask because, you know, so I went to school in the early 2000s to college. But I had about a year's worth of AP credits. So I had Gen Ed requirements, but I opted out. And, you know, there are kids that go with 2 years. There are kids that go with associate's degrees now. I just wonder if we're seeing less core credits in college because there's this push to do them in high school.
You know, I think that's true. There's no question that this, and we, it's a national phenomena, but we see it especially here in Ohio very strongly. Indeed, the community colleges, some of them get 25-30% of their enrollment now from kids who are actually in high school.
Uh-huh.
And they're not even on a community college campus. And since the community college degrees are two-year degrees, some of them do 40, maybe 30% of their work or so while they're in their high school. And then some of them graduate from community college. I had a nephew who graduated from community college in, I think, 6 months or something. Ridiculous right. Short period.
You know, Jeremy Young, tell us about Penn America and where you're coming from at Penn America, where you lead the effort to fight government censorship in educational institutions.
Well, thank you, Ann. Penn America is a 100-year-old free speech and human rights organization made up of writers. Our members are writers all over the country. We are one of the largest, actually, of over 100 Penn centers all around the world. And our mission is to advocate for reading and writing and for the free expression that makes those things possible. So we are very concerned with higher education and have been for almost a decade in a couple of ways. Initially, our concern was probably not that different from some of the concerns shared by the National Association of Scholars, the concern about an increase in censorious culture and attitudes on college campuses emanating from the left. You know, we have criticized student groups and faculty groups who have shouted down speakers and hounded conservative professors out of their jobs because of their unpopular views. Just over the last year, we've weighed in, in criticizing some DEI professionals at Georgetown, at Hamline University in Minnesota, for things that we thought were censorious toward faculty. In the last couple of years, we have added to that mission a focus on legislation, state level legislation, which we think is even more censorious. Some of this legislation is billed as a direct response to the sort of campus climate of censorship on the left, but it is replacing a climate of sort of cultural orthodoxy with the official government suppression of speech. So that a lot of the work I do at Penn America is responding to these bills, many of which we call educational gag orders, bills that really do ban speech about particular types of ideas or viewpoints on campus, and that's the work that we do.
Anna Staver made the salient point that there's research out of University of Wisconsin
and Virginia
that shows that the chill on speech and on college campuses and universities isn't coming from instructors and professors and so forth. It's coming from fellow students and peer groups. Jeremy Young, I'm sure you're aware of that. What about that in what you're trying to do?
It's a really interesting finding, and there was a study at the University of North Carolina system last year that found the same thing. These major studies across multiple campuses, they cover the flagship campus, which has a tendency to have a more liberal student population, but also regional campuses, which don't. And they find the same thing at each of these campuses, that essentially conservative students do feel very afraid to speak on campus to share their views, but they do not feel afraid to share their views, for the most part, because of what their liberal professors are doing. Now, this is hard, I think, for people to wrap their brains around, because it is true that the large majority of professors, particularly in humanities departments, are liberal.
Right.
But what is left out is the fact that the majority of professors are also effective teachers, and an effective teacher creates a welcoming environment for students to speak their views. What these students are afraid of is is how their peers will judge them outside of the classroom, how they'll be judged or attacked on social media, whether they'll be shunned in social groups.
Yeah.
Now, this is a serious problem, but it is a problem because it is a problem driven by students. It's a problem that can be solved through education. Students are on campus to learn. What we need is to inculcate free expression values on campus from orientation to graduation. We need free expression trainings and orientation. We need free expression programming on campus. This is a real practical solution. What we don't need is state laws that shut down speech from one side in a misguided effort to create to recreate the censorship that perhaps conservative students feel on the left as well. That's completely counterproductive. It doesn't solve the problem.
So, Richard Vedder, what are your thoughts about this dichotomy that the fear is not coming from? They're not afraid of the professors. They're afraid of peer judgment.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. The students are very peer oriented, if you like, in this age, particularly in this age of social media. I think with respect to what we're facing here in Ohio, there's not an awful lot of intimidation or attempt to constrain speech in the legislative attempts that have come up, at least as I read them. If there were, I would be against it, because I am 97 to 99% in agreement with Jeremy. I'm a professor. I want free expression in the classroom. I don't want governors or legislators telling me what I can say or not say or teach. By and large, and if I thought that the legislative attempts, either in Ohio or in other states, were severely constraining that, I think I would be very much opposed to that. But as I read what I'm an Ohioan, and I've gotten involved a little bit in this Ohio effort. I think by and large, it has the good outweigh the bad. I like Jeremy, I don't like politicians telling me what to do in the classroom. But I don't think that's really what's going on here very much. I don't see much of that in this. But I also see sometimes that universities and their faculty tend to try to inculcate in students particular ideologies which are inappropriate for universities to do.
Why do you think that, Richard Vedder? What is it, just anecdotal evidence, or is there empirical evidence that that is happening? Why do you think that?
Why do I think that they're
inculcating, and that they're consciously inculcating left-wing or liberal ideology?
Well, I'll just give you a personal experience. I'm theoretically retired, although here I am on your show. you'll face this too, Anne, in a few days, okay. Believe me. I'm theoretically retired, but I was asked to sign a diversity statement the other day that says I strongly believe in providing equal opportunities for all, and I am... this and that, and there were aspects of the statement that I were very uncomfortable with. It was trying to dictate what I believe, and I just thought that was inappropriate. I'm a distinguished professor at my university, and they say if you want to be a distinguished professor at my university, and there are only about a dozen of us, by the way, I have to sign this diversity statement.
Okay.
I think that's outrageous.
All right, Jeremy, I want to take a break, but I want to give you a chance to respond to that, and how you know what Richard Vedder's saying there about having to sign a statement pledging something like that.
Well, I think Richard and I agree that that mandatory diversity statements are a bad idea. The real question is this bill that we're talking about in Ohio, SB 83. You know, there is it goes far beyond restricting mandatory diversity statements. There's a passage in this bill that would require mandatory discipline of students who, in the judgment of some university authority, interfere with the intellectual diversity rights of someone on campus as determined by the university. You know, there's a provision in this bill that requires that would ban universities from expressing an opinion on sustainability, because that's a controversial topic, whether sustainability is environmental sustainability is a good idea. This is a bill that purports to be something that is very narrow, that just restricts the excesses in DEI initiatives, but it also bans the existence of diversity DEI departments. It restricts all sorts of other things in the university. It goes far beyond what it says on the tin. That is our real concern with it. If it's simply a bill that, you know, banned the kind of statements that Richard's talking about, we might prefer that ban comes from inside the university, but, you know, we wouldn't be shouting from the rooftops about it.
We're going to take a break. That is Jeremy Young. He's the Freedom to Learn Director at Penn America, where he leads the organization's efforts to fight government censorship in educational institutions. Also with us is Richard Vetter. He's a professor emeritus of economics at Ohio University. He's a board member for the National Association of Scholars. That is a traditionalist nonprofit pushing for legislative changes to higher education, including supporting Senate Bill 83 in Ohio, which has now moved to the Ohio House. Also with us, Anna Staver, political reporter for USA Today's Ohio Network Ohio Bureau. She covers state house politics for the Columbus Dispatch. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to The Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Passionate debate and discussion of controversial topics were once the hallmark of higher education, or let's just, we thought it was. In the latest high-stakes political standoff, Republicans and legislatures across the country are working on bills that are very similar to each other to more closely manage what is taught in public colleges and universities. 34 bills that would ban spending on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs have been introduced in 20 states, including Ohio. It's according to the Chronicle of Higher Education. Still with us is reporter Anna Staver with USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Jeremy Young, who leads efforts to fight government censorship for Penn America, and Richard Vetter, a member of the board of the National Association of Scholars, a traditionalist organization pushing for more legislative control over how controversial topics are covered in public colleges and universities. We are just, I feel like, as usual, scratching the surface, but we must forge ahead. Jeremy, you've said that these bills, regardless, you know, we can't get into every single provision in the bill, and you made that point, you know, very well. There's so much in Senate Bill 82, but let's talk about the chilling effect on speech and how that happens. I particularly want to talk about students grading professors and having those grades count for a large percentage of the professor's ability to advance and maintain their tenure.
So the bill does include a provision that would make student evaluations a key component of advancement for faculty. Really, I think the concern with bills like this, one of the things we've seen in tracking this type of bill over the last few years, is that these bills are actually not enforced directly by the government very frequently. Instead of direct censorship, which does happen occasionally, usually to make an example of a school or an individual, usually what we see is a broad chilling effect, which has two components. One, administrative censorship, where universities find the language in these bills to be vague and therefore are very concerned about what might potentially violate the bill because it's not clear to them, and then basically ban faculty from doing all sorts of things that aren't specifically specified in the bill because they could potentially violate the bill. And secondly, self-censorship, where faculty members, students, other campus constituents, you know, censor themselves because they're afraid of what might happen if they say the wrong thing. The language in these bills is not as precise as it could be. You know, we argue that that's intentional in some cases, that the goal is to make you know, faculty and universities concerned about a broad spectrum of things so that they simply avoid talking about those topics altogether. And, you know, that is the real risk here. You know, bills that require mandatory punishments, that have, you know, anyone can report anyone else for anything that they said that might be some sort of violation of intellectual diversity rights. You know, that's a bill that is going to leave everyone on campus very afraid that that essentially someone in the legislature is going to change the rules and punish them if they say something wrong.
Richard Vedder?
Well, I want to pick up on something Jeremy said just in passing, I think, a few minutes ago, that really is at what concerns me the most. And although I would argue, I agree with Jeremy on a large part of what he said. The universities are often taking stands on issues as institutions, as if there is a common body of knowledge and a common conformity of ideas on campus. Our university believes strongly in sustainability. Our university believes strongly in equality of opportunity, whatever. Universities are making statements like this all the time. The presidents of universities, as if they're representing universities. Universities should be marketplaces of ideas where people of all kinds of different persuasions and perspectives can battle it out and argue with one another over what is the optimal policy that should be followed. Universities should not be taking stands on issues themselves. What, and some of these are politically popular things these days, things that most people agree on, but universities should just be a place where people can battle amongst themselves verbally, not physically, and advance knowledge and student knowledge and learning that way. And I think we have too little of that and too much of universities trying to intervene in public policy issues, for example, where they don't have any business being themselves participants.
Yeah, Anna Stever, you were talking about something off air that I wanted you to follow up on.
Yeah, I think this feeds into it perfectly. So in the hearings in the House that have started for SB 83, there was a conversation between Representative Casey Weinstein, one of the only Jewish members of the legislature, and the bill sponsor. And the question was, when you have to create these classrooms free from bias, where we have this free exchange of ideas, whether a professor might be worried about, say, dispelling a belief that the Holocaust didn't happen.
So, it's a class on the history of the Holocaust.
Or like world history.
World history. Okay.
And so if somebody doesn't believe that the Holocaust occurred and the professor says that's just factually untrue and pushes them down, have they violated the tenets of this law? And there was a difficult conversation between Representative Weinstein and Serino, and Serino talked about what his personal beliefs are, but Representative Weinstein's concern was that if you say have somebody, a flat earther or somebody who believes in a widely dispelled conspiracy theory like the Holocaust never happened, could you tell that the class that like that right. is not true without violating the law?
Yeah. Where do you draw the line, Professor Vedder?
Well,
who gets to draw the line, I guess, more importantly?
I don't like drawing lines very
okay.
much as a rule. You get some crazies out there who will argue the Holocaust didn't happen. As a professor, I would say, I don't believe that's true. I think the empirical evidence is inconsistent with that position. But I wouldn't say you can't say this. I'm a absolutist. I'm saying you can say any darn thing you want.
But you can also say, but I totally disagree and all the evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, that's roughly
okay.
Right.
Yeah. Jeremy Young, does the scenario that Anna's describing suggest anything to you?
Yes, I think this points out the real problem at the root of these bills, which is that you cannot legislate these questions. That my answer on this is, you know, not too different from Professor Vetter's. I think that this is a disciplinary question. It would be addressed by the department chair, by the faculty in the department, you know, whether they feel that faculty member is accurately reflecting the history, if it's a history class, accurately reflecting the history of that period. But it's not something, you know, once you say that you have to, you know, it's one thing to say that institutions should be neutral. It's another thing to say that the government gets to decide what neutral looks like. That's the problem. And there, you know, it is a very important principle, both internationally and in the United States, that public universities have some degree of autonomy from direct partisan control by the legislature. You know, there is the reason that campus free speech exists is because people on campus can feel, students, faculty, staff, whoever, can feel that they are free to express their opinions without the legislature or the governor or some politician stepping in and telling them that they're not allowed to say this or that. And what these bills do in the name of banning DEI or other you know, ideologies that their authors don't like, is they erode that barrier between direct partisan control and the institution, and they put lawmakers in charge of universities, in charge of governance decisions, things like what neutrality looks like, what a mission statement looks like, what a professor, you know, what someone saying in class is a line or is not. And then, you know, that's what you end up with, is the government controlling what can be said. And so that's a real serious concern. I think that raises it very well.
Yeah, Richard Vetter.
Yeah, well, I think Jeremy and I are maybe agreeing too much in terms of not providing the audience with some food for thought. And so maybe at this point I should make a point that I think Senator Serino would agree with. He was the one who initiated all of this. Mm-hmm. And which I agree with, and that is, colleges and universities are becoming much less popular than they used to be with the general public. And the best evidence is enrollments. In Ohio, over the last decade, 65,000 fewer students are going to state universities today than a decade
ago.
Well,
isn't that because they can't afford to?
Well, there's an affordability issue, of course, but colleges weren't very affordable in 2012 either. And in the last decade, why has in the last decade the University of Akron enrollment fallen 48%? Why has Wright State's enrollment fallen 39%? Why has Cuyahoga Community College's enrollment?
Is there evidence that this is why, that there's the feeling that the colleges are biased? Is there evidence of that's why?
Well, the reality is it's happening. The enrollments are happening. Now, by the way, part of this is due to birth rate, you know, changes in demography.
Sure.
I'm not saying it's all because of people are unhappy with colleges in general, but part of it is. And we have to, and normally I would agree with Jeremy. I am distrustful of third parties, in this case, governments, interfering with what universities do. But if universities get so far out of line with what public opinion is, if universities are doing things that the public thinks are inappropriate, if universities are putting limits on freedom of expression itself, then I think someone has to step in. And that someone are the people that are funding this. Universities are funded partially by state governments.
Well,
so
it's extremely less than it was 10 or 15
yeah,
years
yeah,
ago.
Oh, absolutely.
As you all know, Jeremy Young, we've got about a minute left. What are your thoughts about that, what Richard Vetter just said?
you know, I want to go back to what Richard said was the heyday of higher education, the 50s and 60s. This was a period of time when the GI Bill was in force as it is now, and when there was also a peacetime draft. So essentially every able-bodied man who served in the peacetime draft got a free ride to college.
Unless
so
you were
surprising.
African-American, but go Unless ahead. You were, yeah.
Right, depending on where you live in the country, mm-hmm. but yes. And, you know, yes, I think that the key here is that this, you know, Richard said that, you know, if a university gets out of step with what the public wants, then it's time to regulate it. The purpose of a university is to be a home for all ideas, including the ideas that are unpopular in a given time or place. I think it's vitally important that the public understand that if you have a university where you regulate some ideas out of existence, you do not have a university anymore. You have a propaganda machine. And it's very important that universities be home to all ideas, especially those that make people uncomfortable, especially those that may be unpopular.
Jeremy Young is the Freedom to Learn Director at Penn America, where he leads the organization's efforts to fight government censorship in educational institutions. I know we just scratched the surface, but I appreciate you joining us in this conversation, Jeremy. Thank you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And the same to you, Richard Vetter, Distinguished Professor and Professor Emeritus of Economics at Ohio University and a board member for the National Association of Scholars. It's a nonprofit pushing for these legislative changes to higher education that we've been talking about. Richard Vetter, thank you so much for your kind words, and thanks for joining us today.
I enjoyed it very much, Ann.
And Anna Staver, political reporter for USA Today's Network Ohio Bureau, covers state politics for the Dispatch. Thanks to you, I'm going to squeeze in as far as I can all the way to the end. Thanks.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.